Accession number 24943,
real one. Medical. Passed A1.
Mm-hmm.
And had the choice of the army or down the mines.
Oh.
I chose the army. I didn't fancy being a coal miner.
Hmm.
Never thought I'd have to go, but I thought 1939, I left school and the war started. I thought, oh, it'll be all before. No. And I can always remember seeing the first airborne lad in Boston. I thought, oh, airborne. Someone had been that airborne. You see, it's voluntary until I went in. You had to volunteer to go in the airborne. And then when there was short of men, the D-Day, you and you, that was it.
Mm.
I was in. Would I like it or not? Mm-hmm. Received my call papers about beginning of mid-May.
Mm-hmm.
I had to report for military service at the barracks at Omaha, County Tara, Northern Ireland. Omaha.
Mm.
O-M-A-G-H, County Tyrone.
Mm-hmm.
Did all my 6 weeks junior training and 6 weeks advanced training there.
Mm-hmm.
After a spot of leave, was posted to the Royal Irish Fusiliers.
Mm-hmm.
The holding battalion.
Yeah.
During the short period of time I was with them, I was erecting tents on Southampton Common for the Americans coming over for the D-Day.
Oh.
They were erecting tents on the camps on the down south for the Americans. Until just a bit late. And then I was, after a short time with doing that, I was posted to the Royal Ulster Rifles, 1st Battalion, 6th Airborne Division.
Mm.
I did 2 training trips in Hotspur gliders. I'd never been away from home until I went in the army. I'd never been on a train or a bus in my life. I had to go to Carlisle the first night and then Northern Ireland for my training. Yeah, anyway, 2 trips on the gliders. After being passed for the airborne, I received my Pegasus chevrons to put on the blazer.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved for training to Woodhall Spa, Lincolnshire. The local bus used to come to Boston every night for people who want to travel to Boston and back. The 1st Division, that was the 1st Airborne Division, was in the Lincolnshire area at that time, so we swapped over barracks. They came to our barracks and we came to their barracks in Lincolnshire for road work, for fitting up ready for the D-Day. We were getting fit by doing a lot of route marches, etc. Really just come to Lincolnshire to get fitted up, and the 1st Div went down our area for flying training. After a month we did a big scheme which was afterwards meant to be a premonition of the D-Day trip.
Cool.
Big scheme, that's right, I forget the name, it's either Mush or Mash, I can't remember. That was what the scheme was called. After that, so it was all marching, and keep fit class. We did one route march one weekend of 70 miles. Started on the Friday afternoon, kept going till Sunday afternoon. We did the 70 mile route march for that. That was a big one. And then after we did the scheme, we moved back to a barracks which was at Bulford on Salisbury Plain, Kiwi Barracks.
Right.
And in the May 1944, we were all transshipped to an aerodrome, didn't know where it was or what, somewhere in Dorset. We were in a wire compound for 4 weeks on the canvas.
Mm-hmm.
This was all in readiness for the D-Day. And while we were there, we were told everything of where we should land, when we should land, where we should land, who lived in the bungalows, the houses. We knew a lot of the names. There were local intelligence and a little bit of inquiring, and we found out through the local resistance that who was right and who was wrong, you know. All in the beachhead, all the lot, yeah. And every day was, morning was keep fit classes of PT, and afternoon was conferences, a briefing, all about what would happen. Every afternoon was briefing. We were shown photographs from the RAF at the aerodrome, as they did reconnaissance. They showed us photographs of the area where we were going, and we actually saw the French digging holes to put these poles up to stop the gliders coming in.
Really?
We could see that the holes being dug each day. The French farmers were paid to cut the trees and hedgerow down and put up in the fields by the Germans. And the French actually wanted us to pay them when we landed. We're doing the work. They asked us for the money. It's true, yeah. They put them up for the Germans, then someone was still messing about doing it and wanted us to pay for doing the job. Yeah. It's very primitive, you see, in them days, in 1944, you see. All there were. No cars or anything. You see, all the coast, you see, was just concrete, everywhere for miles and miles of it. Unstoppable. Just kept going right down, right through to Cherbourg. There were the poles were the lumps of edges, long pieces of edges, because the edges were riverside there. See, they didn't cut them down, they just let them grow high. So they cut them out and trimmed them off and put them in the fields to be an obstacle for the gliders landing. Well, everywhere was expecting, you see, getting nearer the time, everybody was talking about the second front, but they didn't know where. A lot of the countryside was mock areas, and it did actually work. It put them off. It worked, yeah. They did. How the secrecy was kept is, I mean, just one word would have done it. I mean, once or twice, some of the different areas that we were going, or what the things were called, came up on the radio. Thought, you know, they thought something was amiss then, but it never came out. It was a complete surprise. Well, the big man had gone back to Germany. Rommel, he went back to Germany till his wife's birthday. There was no invasion. There was. He was in Germany. The head man. And some of the Germans were on the evening we went over, they were practicing for an invasion. And they didn't know. It was a total surprise. It was frightening. It really was. I mean, well, we didn't know what was going on. We had a clue. Everything. We trained. We were 100% fit. I'll say that. We could go anywhere, we could do anything, and we were really on top song. We were keyed up right to the bit. We'd been a crowd of lads all together, all the same age. It just carried you. The gliding one, it just got you. Well, it was for the authorities to know if you could fly, if you weren't seasick or airsick. You're never airsick, and it was bumpy, I'll tell you. It was a little glider up there, and it was up and down. And the weather was getting bad, you see, so. Therefore, there was a lot of turmoil up there. Came through with flying colours and was put in the airborne in June, and it was cancelled. We were all pretty all keyed up, ready for off, and the weather was too rough. We couldn't fly, so they couldn't. Everything was put at a standstill for 24 hours. And then they got the message that there was a break in the weather. So many hours, so Eisenhower did say we go. Oh yeah, they did a glider landing at St Mary on Englese. In there was a actual real glider. Theirs was made of tube of steel with canvas all right, and ours was all wood, three ply wood, stuck together. The only metal parts in the glider was the wheels and the controls. The rest was, well, it was compressed pine wood. And the structure, the reinforcements inside, was three plywood, about that thing. Three plywood, that's it. That sort of thing. Okay. Might have been five in some cases. It was nothing more than plywood anyway. And that was the framework inside. Six releasing, quick releasing pins in the tail unit. So if it would carry a Jeep, and a trailer or a jeep and a little gun, just a back of mince out, and then as soon as the glider had landed, pull these quick releasing pins out of the fuselage section, knock that off, two jumped out and rolled it out of the way, two slid the ramps out, and then drove it out, six to eight, I should imagine. The whole platoon, 29, took the whole of the glider, nothing else. They pull right through, you see, your jeep, and then your trailer, you see. The gun crew used to be with it, the gun and the sardine of the gun. It'd be a gun crew of probably eight, I should imagine. I know 320 gliders went to Normandy. I'm not talking about Americans, and only two didn't make it. One never got away from England because the rope broke, and the other had to go back. You see, that 320 was two whole battalions of troops, and two and a half battalions of the Royals, the Rifles, there was the Oxen Bucks, and there was half the battalion of the Devons. There aren't enough gliders to take the other half, so they went by sea. Of the gliders, you see, you've got the Royal Engineers. They were taking, some of these were all loaded up with bits of pontoon bridges for the to do the river crossings, and Hamel cars, which took small tanks, and the front used to open up this section, and then everything used to come out like the front.
Good afternoon on D-Day. The paratroopers went in the morning, early morning.
Yeah.
They landed on these areas which we were going to come in with the gliders, so they'd got to take these poles up.
Right.
Get as many of those up as can. Try and make as many runways through these fields.
Right.
So the gliders could come in.
Yeah.
So they've got to get these lumps over and get them out of the way. Excuse me. And then try and fill these holes in so they weren't too bumpy for it landing. Well, they'd been harassed, so half the job was done when we got there. We landed about 2 hours, I think, probably, in the air.
Mm.
So between 8 and 9 o'clock we landed, just on getting done. I'll say on takeoff, don't know what aerodrome, but all the gliders was down the side of the runway, and the two planes were in between. So when the first one went off, he pulled the first glider, and as he was moving, the one on the other side of the runway started up and took the next glider. So they were going all like that all the way.
Right.
Until they all got up together. It was all in formation, and we kept that formation all the time. We were fighter cover, hundreds of fighters above us, but we never saw one, but they were there. Took us over. Well, I've been told Rushton Tarrant, but I've never caught either Rushton Tarrant or Broadwell or another little aerodrome. Just in that area. I know the gliders were at Rushton Tarrant, but whether we all went from there or what, I don't know. They went in the morning with the paratroopers, came back to England, and then took us over. These and Ammervilles, they were twin engine light bombers as well. They were very obsolete aeroplane, but they did the job. They got us, they took us there. Then your Hamel car, your heavier ones, well, the four engine, the Halifaxes and the Stirling bombers, took them over. After the incident of the takeoff with the wingtip catching the aerodrome, I'm thinking, well, how are we going to get there? And then you sit there, and what shall I say? Everybody's tense, you can look at everybody, and they're all just sitting. Now, some have a cigarette, nobody's speaking, and you really are tensed up and frightened. I was petrified, really. Mm. And you sit there and you think, well, what did I think? Well, Eric, this is it. You're on your way now. Mm. And we got up. Get there, you know, you've got to kill. You've got to kill first to survive. And that went in my mind, and I thought, now, if I kill a German, his parents are going to get a notification that he's been killed in Germany. And if he kills me, my mum's going to get the same. And what have we got to do? Got to kill him first. And that's the attitude I took. In one area I felt sorry for them, and on the other hand I thought, well, it's their fault I'm here, so why worry about them? And when I got down, and we got down, made a perfect landing, got out the glider perfect, we had to rush to get off the aerodrome, off the landing zone, because all the gliders was coming in, and he didn't know which way they were coming from. You'd rather run into a glider and run over you. They're all coming at the same time, all looking for a space to get down, you see. And eventually we got off the landing zone and rendezvoused near Randall. Rendezvoused on the edge of this area. And the sergeant, he took us to into Randall. Well, it turned out, Randall turned out to be our headquarters. We couldn't get any further from Randall that night. We were supposed to have gone to Cairn, really. Cairn that night, but we were stopped by a heavy machine gun nest on the crossroads between Randall and the column. Big factory of the column, though. On D-Day night, well, we dug in on the outskirts of Randall, trenching all about that long, with a little shovel and one spade, because there wasn't enough room for them. And then we just dug in on that corner for the evening. What a night. A night I'll never forget in my life. Mm. This thing was happening. You see, they were bombing Cairn with a bombing. As you said, Dakotas was coming back with supplies, and they were dropping parachute containers with ammunition and food. We just carried two 24-hour packs in our haversacks of concentrated food, oatmeal and that. Then when the planes come over with the supplies, the Germans thought there was more paratroopers coming in, so they opened up on the container machine. It was just like a big firework display got out of hand. Put it into words at all. Nerve-wracking, everything was banging and exploding. Didn't know where the Germans was or anything then, because nothing was organised. I mean, if you see German, you kill them. Saw a German that night, only a dead one. Never saw a live German.
No.
It was all the dead ones. What? Put a wound here on my knee. Wrapped myself up, got it better myself. Didn't stop. Nowhere to go, really. Where can you go when you drop in the middle of anywhere? Until the beachhead come through, you ain't got your main dressing station yet. We'd only a temporary advanced dressing station, stretches, that's all. And I just put a field dressing on it, only just dropped my skin, that's all. Of it. What it was, isn't it? Just put the dressing on it and kept going.
You just carried on?
Oh, well, I had to. I didn't want to be hanging about there. No. Mushrooms, nephews and that. Never knew what I'd done.
Mm.
And when I got into this and they've seen me undressed, I never knew Uncle Eric did that.
Mm.
I came in contact with a German proper on the first morning, and that was at that village of Longerville. We liberated Longerville the day after D-Day. That's the first village we went into, and that's where the first attack was against the Germans. Yeah. And then went to the next village. We nearly got into the village and the tanks pulled out. German tanks. And we had to withdraw. We couldn't do nothing with them.
Mm.
We made it back to Randall. And the RAF come. Typhoons and prompts. No, there was a right hand bend, and there was a German knelt in the middle of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And he hadn't tumbled over, he was dead. He got a hole in the back of his head. And he just sat there in it, and then he put him on hundreds of times. That's German.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
You just see him on him, just on that corner. And the tile had been to brother, said, oh, this is the corner where I still can pick it out, everything. And I mean, I was just about off my head then. B+2.
Mm-hmm.
3 days after, 2 days after,
yeah,
okay. Flaked out. Yeah. It was on all action all the time. You couldn't afford to sleep. Never wash, never shave, nothing. 3 days, three nights. Maybe our own units come up with mobile kitchen, but there was nothing really, not for the first week anyway. Supplies was coming in, you see, that was most important. Really was up against it. And we dug in, and I've been back to the farmyard there. And been to the farm where I actually dug in for the week. We just dug a hole in the ground. What is it, all about four of us. We stole some wood, lined all the inside, and we got some heavy planks and put over the top. Stole a hood off an old car, sports car, in one of the buildings, put it on the top, and then covered it with silver. I dug out when I went on duty. That's where we slept. And I went on duty in a slip trench or something.
What was the bottom lined with? Did you put something down?
No, we got a
tarpaulin.
Parachute.
Oh.
We got found one of the parachutes on the paratroop boys. Used it.
Yeah. Was it damp?
Oh yes, yeah. Yeah. No choice. We were in Breville quite a while actually.
Yeah.
That was defensive position totally.
Yeah.
When we went in, it was just a massive carnage of cattle in the fields, all with the feet up in the air, about three times the size they should be.
Blown up.
And the carnage of our own lads and the Germans. Regrouped and was on standby, and then we had to go to the Ardennes. And the Battle of the Bulge started when everything got mobile and they got going out of France into Belgium. Well, then when they got into Belgium, Holland as well, and while we were in England, we were reforming and getting trained up ready for another operation, which was being over the Rhine crossing. What we were training for, the Rhine crossing, well, we didn't need a lot of training because most of us was used to what we was going to. During that period, from getting back to England and the Rhine crossing, the Battle of the Bulge happened when they broke through the American sector in the Ardennes. So we had to sail from Folkestone, the old division, sail from Folkestone on Christmas Eve. Went to Ostend and we sailed from Ostend. We put in lorries, travelled from Ostend to the Ardennes all day Christmas Day. Demoralised we were. And we were in the area, I think it was between somewhere in Dinant area in Belgium. Dug in the woods, never saw a dead German or a live one. Dug in the ground for 3 weeks. Only got out of the dugout to relieve ourselves, that's all. Ground sheets to keep the snow from blowing in the trenches. And we stood on sticks so we weren't in water at the bottom. And there was about that much frost in the ground. More or less the same thing. Well, not everything, but in our sector, was just a standstill because we couldn't move because of the weather. It snowed, it froze, and everything was solid and slippery. Terrible. We didn't move anyway. We just sat in slip trenches for 3 weeks. Went back to our own barracks, in Bulford, Salisbury. Retrained again, did a bit more flying training, and ready for D-Day. That was to bring the reinforcements that made the battalion up. They took them from the holding battalions to make us to full strength. As a matter of fact, with some that went with me when we were called up, and that was really to assist the Americans who were so thin on the ground that the Germans broke through, and we went help to fill the gaps up. We got sorted out. We moved up to Holland then, dug in on the edge of the River Maas, holding the area there while they got it all. The Germans were just waiting for them. Terrible it was. Mm. It leaked out and they were just waiting.
Mm.
And they'd strengthened, stronger than what we knew. They'd got better troops there than what anybody realised. And awful. And then we held on there for so long, and the British forces moved further up, ready for the Arnhem landing. And we came back to England again to regroup. And we went over the Rhine crossing then, with the gliders and the airborne. But I didn't go. I was on compassionate leave, and I went back off leave the night as I went over in the morning. But I was on standby, ready to join them, but I was never wanted anyway. Of course, then I come back from when VE Day come up and the war finished in Europe, and we were kitted out ready to go to the Far East then, training in the jungle warfare, etc. All the senior NCOs were out there training ready. for when we got out there, but we were never needed. The war finished and peace was there, and no sooner we got celebrations over and off we had to go to Palestine. Sort that out. In Palestine about a year, in flies by the millions, ants by the millions, and orange groves, banana groves, the best part of the town, saying Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv was a lovely place, and Haifa, the better part of Haifa was nice.
Mm-hmm.
When you got to the bad part of the gap, yeah, it was. We did patrols at night in Jerusalem mostly for terrorists and that sort of thing.
Mm.
Yeah, make sure everybody knew what everybody was and where they were. And then we did a stunt on the High Commissioner's House Guard in that, end of 1947. Then we moved to Villach in Austria, did a stunt on the Austrian Yugoslav border, on the border duties, checking, right up the top of the mountains, right up the top of the Alps in the sunshine, in the snow. It really was nice, yeah. It was snow and yet it was sunburnt. After the border thing, we went up into the international zone, which was all spit and polish. Shomron Palace first. It was a massive place, the palace one. And they took over there from the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
Did a ceremonial takeover from the Russians, right down the driveway to Shomron Palace. The palace was big drive on the front, big area to the front, then the big palace, and round the back was massive garden, huge fountains. Well, they weren't working because it was wartime, it was all out of commission. Nobody in the palace, only caretakers.
Okay.
And we had 2, 4, 6 people on guard each time. 2 on the main gate, 2 on the entrance to the palace front lane, 2 at the back, no, 8 there was, 2 patrols at the back. And that was 3 shifts, so 24 men on guard. Went into Vienna to the Hofburg Palace, and that's where recently Blair's been having the meetings out there. He's been in that, but it's a lovely palace. And there I had to raise 17 flags a day there. I had to put up and take down at 4 of each country and 1 Union Jack. And that one the bad guard actually, and then I went on to the Palace of Justice. That's where all the courts used to be held and that sort of thing, and some of the. Then I did a special guard for the big meeting of the 4 powers, right? All the general of each power met, and they had a big conference and had a former guard of honour for them. Yeah. He had to spit and polish my rifle for that. That's the thing, I never spit and polish my rifle. Done my boots and everything, but. Yeah, they inspected the guard, all 4 generals, at a different time. I don't know how they came, which rotation. I think the British bloke was last. But they took it first, maybe the